many, many questions also as to who constituted an Italian national. So again, this, over time we see a distinction of national and foreign refugee, but it was much more complex on the ground, as one might imagine. And just to give one example, from the Venezia-Julian border area, there was the 1947 peace treaty with Italy that set out a citizenship option. So people who had been resident in the territory at the time of Italy's entry into the war in 1940, and who were said to speak Italian as customary language, lingua d'uso, could opt to retain Italian citizenship or declare Italian citizenship, but that would require them to move to a territorially redefined Italian state. So this area that was ceded to Yugoslavia. And you had, so the problem here was this was an area of widespread bilingualism because there had been strong Italianization campaign under fascism. And IRO comes into the scene and they decide that anyone who either has opted for Italian citizenship is an ethnic Italian. So if they've migrated, let's say, to Trieste, even if they've turned up at the IRO offices asking for help to immigrate overseas, stating that they were persecuted or had a fear of the communist regime, the IRO initially dismisses all of these cases, says these are Italians and they're the responsibility of the Italian government. But then if someone was Slavic and IRO found itself in the business of trying to determine people's ethnicity, they were eligible for help if they'd come from the ceded territory to Italy. In some cases, even if they'd opted for Italian citizenship. You had a very confused array of statuses that IRO was trying to sort through. And the end result of this is that IRO ultimately made a number of exceptions and developed this category of undetermined Venezia-Julian in order to recognize the complexities on the ground. But this particular story is sort of the exception that proves the rule, because in later instances when, for example, officials from the Italian government sought to use this as a precedent and to argue that Italians coming from the Aegean Islands, for example, should also be considered undetermined in precisely the same way, and that they should be eligible for international relief as refugees, there was a categorical denial or rejection of those questions. So all of this, I mean, is to say that when you reconstruct these requests, these decisions, it highlights this very complicated situation through which strategic exclusions happen. So I see this much more as a story of exclusions over time than inclusions. Now, one, in trying to say, okay, how can we move from this particular story and the refugee story to a larger conclusion about human rights? I mean, maybe this refugee story is anomalous within the human rights story at the same time. Yet, I think people like Daniel Cohen in his recent work have really persuasively argued that the international activities around displacement, around displaced persons at the end of World War II are absolutely formative and essential for what he sees as the human rights revolution after 1945. So I think that the refugee story isn't exceptional or marginal. It's quite central to the larger human rights history in this time period. So I think I'll stop there, except to urge us to think about, you know, ways, whether in fact what I'm identifying as a story more about exclusions than inclusions, whether we can find other instances of this, or, I mean, again, I don't want to right now rewrite a linear narrative, but just going in the opposite direction, but how to think about challenging this kind of standard narrative of cascading rights and, thinking about also the language, the metaphors at work in someone like Lynn Hunt's work, I was trying to think about, okay, maybe it's not a cascade where rights sort of stream and pool together and they gather this force, but maybe it's a funneling or a winnowing and a diversion of some energies into a primary channel with other streams. So I don't know. I'm struggling with the metaphors as well, and I wonder. I mean, I just wonder what might be at stake even in that language of cascades and the watery metaphors there. So, what's that?
Can we make the water?
There we go. That's the connection.
Thank
so
you.
Thank
Pat.
You.
Thanks. While we were speaking, our provost, Ralph Hexter, walked in. Would you like to do something now, or can you stay with us for a little while?
I'm
going to
stay for another 35 minutes.
Okay, great. Glenn? Sure, yeah. Thanks as well to you, Keith, and to everyone for showing up and for putting this thing together. I mean, I think it's very exciting to have this development within the UC system. Generally, I'm a graduate of UC Santa Cruz. I did my undergraduate there. I certainly think that this is going to benefit from an expansion of commitment to exploring human rights, particularly from a historical angle. And of course, this conference in particular speaks to my general interests. I'm a historian of the development of the UN human rights system in the 1940s. And so my paper, which I'll try and be brief. I don't know if I'm. I took the idea that these were working drafts quite seriously, as you probably noticed, and I took the idea that these were informal remarks quite seriously. So they may therefore be both inadequate. But at any rate, so I'll try and give you a sketch of where this project is coming from. The paper I wrote for the conference is a kind of direct response or a direct meditation on Sam Moyne's recent interventions, in which he described the period of the 1940s as a period of catastrophic failure for human rights. Besides putting my entire career in jeopardy, that certainly seemed to be an inadequate way of describing exactly what happened there. So I tried to think through, and so this is based on work that's going to appear as my book for my dissertation